Welcome to the Gila Members Community Radio Show, Earth Matters, which brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. We aim to inform, challenge, engage, and inspire our listeners. Three hosts alternate weekly shows to bring the listener a broad range of topics and expertise. I'm Donna Stevens, the director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and I'm your co-host for today's program. With me for this special show is Allison Civic, the executive director of both the Gila Conservation Coalition and the Gila Resources Information Project.
Good morning, Donna.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for being here. Today, we are going to talk about the Gila River Festival, which takes place September 19th to 22nd, right here in Silver City and surrounding area. So first, I wanted to ask you, Allison, what is the theme of this year's festival?
Sure. Well, this is the 9th annual Gila River Festival, and this year's theme is The Gila River is in Our Hands. And this year we're tackling the big issue of climate change and the fact that here we are trying to protect the Gila River, and we have this big looming elephant in the closet, climate change, that we're already seeing the impacts of climate change here in our area in the Southwest. We've seen some of the largest fires. I think the Whitewater Baldy fire that occurred last summer is still the largest fire in New Mexico's history. Had another fire this year, the Silver Fire. The fact that the Gila River and the Gila region is experiencing long-term drought. The Gila River is expected to cease to be a snowpack-fed river by mid-century. All of these things are impacting our Gila watershed, and we're going to talk about that in this year's River Festival. We've got a keynote speaker by Ken Brower, the son of pioneering environmentalist David Brower. He's right now working on a book about climate change. And then he's going to be speaking Thursday night at 7 o'clock at the Western New Mexico University Global Resource Center Auditorium. But we also have Tom Swetnam, who runs the Center for Tree Ring Research at the University of Arizona over in Tucson. He's going to be talking about wildfire and climate changes in the Southwest. He's going to be telling us about some of the tree ring data and what really this has meant in the past and what it means to us in the future in terms of climate change. And he's really going to set the stage for a series of panel discussions that we'll be having on local climate adaptation. And this will feature a number of local folks. Dr. Emma Bailey over at from the Environmental Sustainability Program at WNMU is going to be talking about the Water Commons. Alicia Edwards from the Volunteer Center talking about food security. Kelly Russell, who's the forest supervisor from the Gila National Forest, she's going to be talking about what climate change means for the Gila National Forest and what the U.S. Forest Service is doing to respond to climate change, both in terms of firefighting and restoration activities. Nick Cicillo, who's the director of the Office of Sustainability. The town has open for draft and public comment right now the Sustainability Plan 2030, which is really how the town proposes to adapt to climate change. So this is really the keynote, and these panel discussions really going to set the stage for discussions throughout the festival on climate change. And finally, on Friday afternoon, we're going to be having a panel discussion on the Endangered Species Act. 2013 is the 40th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act. And we have botanist Jack Carter, fish biologist Dave Probst, and attorney Cindy Toole, who will be talking about how the Endangered Species Act has really been a tool to help recover threatened and endangered species, many of which are being threatened by climate change.
So Tom Swetnam is going to speak on Thursday afternoon, and he's kind of setting the stage for what we can expect to see in the Southwest. But then, so that it's not all, as people like to say, gloom and doom about what we think will happen with climate change, these local people, as you mentioned, Emma Bailey, Alicia Edwards, Kelly Russell, Nick Cicillo, are going to talk about what we're doing here locally to kind of soften the blow of what we expect to have happen here locally.
That's right. And also in terms of how we do that from a water perspective, Friday afternoon, we have another panel discussion with Todd Schulke, one of the founders of the Center for Biological Diversity and also one of the partners in the Gila Conservation Coalition, Martha Cooper from the Nature Conservancy, and Denise Smith from the Town Office of Sustainability. They're all going to be talking about ways in which we can build more resilient communities and a resilient Gila River in the face of climate change. So what are some of the things we can be doing in terms of land protection and restoration to protect the Gila River? How can we make our water supplies go further through water conservation? And also in terms of the Arizona Water Settlements Act and some of these questions that we're going to be addressing here in 2014 in terms of how we meet our future water supply needs under the Arizona Water Settlements Act. And will we protect the Gila River or not? Will we divert water from the Gila River? Todd Schulke is going to be talking about what are some of those non-diversion alternatives that we can be implementing under the Arizona Water Settlements Act that help us meet our future water supply needs, but can help us at the same time keep water in the Gila River. So we hope to have a really interesting panel discussion on Friday afternoon, September 20th. And all of these panel discussions take place at the Global Resource Center Auditorium. And I should mention, all of the panel discussions are free. And also the keynote with Ken Brower, that's by donation only. However, students are free. So we're not going to turn anybody away at the door. So anybody who wants to hear Ken can come in and listen to him.
So you talked about, you mentioned the Arizona Water Settlements Act, and I understand that a recent project that took place here in Silver City at the Ben Altamirano ball fields was actually paid for with AWSA funding. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So one of the water conservation demonstration projects, there were two projects funded by the Interstate Stream Commission using AWSA funding, one of which is being implemented by the town of Silver City to install a smart irrigation system at the Ben Altamirano ball fields. The other is being implemented by the city of Deming, and that is they're offering rebates for water-efficient appliances, xeriscaping, and I think low-flow toilets. So two projects really to demonstrate how effective water conservation measures are in southwestern New Mexico. And we hope that more funding will be coming down the line next year as the state makes a decision on how to use AWSA funding. Remember, we've got $66 million to spend in non-reimbursable funding, meaning we don't have to pay it back. It just has to be used on funding water supply demands. And so that really allows us to spend a whole bunch of money on things like water conservation, drip irrigation for agriculture, improving irrigation efficiency, restoration, a whole bunch of things. So we'll be talking about that in that panel.
So I also understand that on Friday night there is a film festival, and that's it features different films about New Mexico rivers. And of course, the Gila River is one of those. But there's also rivers in the state that are in trouble too. And I wonder if you could kind of set that in context. Like, it isn't just the Gila River that's in trouble, but there are others in the state as well.
Sure. Yeah. The New Mexico Rivers Film Fest is really an opportunity for us to give people a sense of not only the plight, the threats to the Gila River, but also to other rivers in the state. And two of the rivers that we'll be highlighting are the Santa Fe River and the Rio Grande. And so we've got Valerie Martinez and Bobby Bessel, two artists from Santa Fe, who last year walked the Santa Fe River from the headwaters to its confluence with the Rio Grande. They did a film about their 50-some-odd mile journey. And again, they're trying to raise awareness about the threats to the Santa Fe River and its watershed. And so they have a 10-minute film. The name of their project is Rivers Run Through Us, and they're really using art as a way to engage the community in dialogue about how to protect the Santa Fe River. And so both Valerie, who I should mention was a former Santa Fe poet laureate, and her colleague Bobby Bessold, who's an eco artist, they're both going to be with us and introducing their film. The second film, Rio Grande, Live River or Dead Ditch, is a film by journalist and filmmaker Joe Day, who is the father of Peter Day of Townside Farm here in Silver City. We're still hoping that Joe's going to be able to join us. I'm not sure yet if he's going to be able to make it down here to Silver City to introduce his film. This film was done about 10 years ago and chronicles all of the issues that are being dealt with on the Rio Grande, and as well as a number of restoration projects that people are doing on the Rio Grande, really to keep water in the river for ecological reasons, including the silvery minnow. And Kevin Bixby from Southwest Environmental Center and Steve Harris from Rio Grande Restoration, they're both going to be with us, sort of bringing us up to date on Rio Grande issues and as an introduction to the film. And then I should say we have two films that we'll be showing about the Gila. The first one, called Free Flow, Saving the Gila River in New Mexico, features writer Dutch Salmon, and he's also the founder of the Gila Conservation Coalition. And I think it was about a month ago here on Earth Matters, we interviewed Dutch about his Gila descending trip. This year is the 30th anniversary of that trip, where he traveled by foot and on canoe from the headwaters of the Gila down to the Solomon Dam in Arizona. And this film, short film, 8 to 10 minutes, really features Dutch reminiscing about that trip as he goes down in the Gila River recently in March. And he talks about how things have changed over 30 years. Oh. And then finally, the other film that we'll be premiering is called The Gila River is in Our Hands. And this film was done by the Gila Conservation Coalition in partnership with WNMU's Interdisciplinary Expressive Arts Program. And Donna and I and Sally Smith, Kate Brown, Shirley Pavarnik, and Peter Bill's class, we've all been working on this film for months now, and we're really excited about premiering it in a little less than 3 weeks.
So this is the world premiere of The Gila River is in Our Hands?
The world premiere.
Okay, well, stay with us. We'll be right back after a break. Today we have with us a special guest, Kenneth Brower, who's joining us from Berkeley. Welcome to Earth Matters, Ken.
Thanks for having me.
Kenneth Brower is the keynote speaker for this year's Gila River Festival. That talk takes place on Thursday, September 19th at 7 p.m. at the Global Resource Center on the WNMU campus. The suggested donation is $10 at the door. This year, our theme is The Gila River is in Our Hands, and it's all about climate change and what we can do as a local community to soften the expected impacts. We'll talk about that a little later in today's show, and we'll also highlight some of the festival's events. First, though, I'd like to ask Ken to talk about the research he's done for his latest book on climate change.
My research has really just been to live in these places and do stories in them. And what's come out for me is as bad as it's going to be for us here, global warming and climate change, we're having our wildfires and our droughts, and we're suffering. But in Oceania, the middle of the Pacific, where these island nations that I have been working in a lot over the last 40 years, really, there are whole republics that are going to just vanish from the face of the earth. We are going to be here. We're going to have our mountains here, but they're not. The Republic of the Maldives, the Republic of the Marshalls, Kiribati, large stretches of the Central Caroline Islands in the Federated States of Micronesia, which used to be a U.S. territory, and atolls and low islands all over Polynesia and Indonesia and Melanesia are going to be gone. It's a different order of magnitude for these folks. In my book, which is still not finished, but I'm about to finish it, it's about low islands. It's not so much about the high islands of the Pacific, the high Tahitis and stuff. It's about the low atolls and low coral islands that are now at risk. And I don't waste time in this book arguing that this phenomenon is happening. Anybody in his right mind now knows that we're full on into this new era. What I wanted to do in this book is just make these places real for people. Make our brothers and sisters in these low islands real for us. These are real people, and they're often from fascinating cultures, and they're not just they're not just figures, and they're not just numbers. I got the idea in the Maldives in 2004. I was doing a dive story, sailing around all the major groups of atolls there, just to describe the underwater situation. I do a lot of, for National Geographic and other people, I do a lot of underwater stories. And the Maldives are really the lowest, they're the flattest and the lowest nation on Earth, 7 feet tops. It's hard for people in New Mexico to grasp this, but that's it, 7 feet of elevation. And the Maldives have about the landmass of Chicago, but it's spread out over thousands of miles of ocean. It's like Chicago blown to smithereens. And they're wonderful places. I love atolls and low islands. And what I always do on this dive story, I look for targets of opportunity. I look for other stories to spin out. And while I was in the Maldives, I always look for something to spin out. I'm traveling on somebody else's dime, and I'll try to make another story out of it. One of the things I thought it might be is Ibn Battuta, this wonderful man I never heard about until I reached the Maldives, but he was the Muslim Marco Polo. He had way more miles on his odometer than Marco Polo ever did. They were almost contemporaries, but he traveled all over the Muslim world at the time. He was in the Maldives. He was really the first person to give us an account of the Maldives. He was the first person I know who ever described a coral atoll, a ring of islands, he said. I don't think the world knew about these places then. And I thought maybe for a while I would do my story, my spin-out story would be on the women of the islands, because I've appreciated the women of the Pacific Islands and Caribbean a lot. And there's lots of warm colors and lots of brown skin and lots of sort of Margaret Mead type islands. These islands, the Maldive Islands, are different. They're Muslim islands, so it's just a different way of being an island woman. Maybe that would be my story, I thought. And then I thought maybe the Humphead Wrasse would be the story. It's this beautiful, the biggest of the wrasses, 500 pounds. Looks like a Maori idol. It's beautifully inlaid with different colors. It has little eyes on stalks that rotate as you dive down to look at them. They're looking back at you. But then I realized that, you know, I thought of my father, who was the first executive director of the Sierra Club and who one of the great evangelists of environmentalism, and I grew up, you know, getting indoctrinated, and I realized I really should do a story on these low islands and the fact that they're at risk and that they're going to be gone. And I write a little about the Marshalls. The Marshall Islands, again, the Republic of the Marshalls, used to be U.S. territory. We still have a close relationship with these islands. They're 7 feet tops above the sea. I approach it through the Marshallese Dictionary. My source there is a guy named Tony de Broom, who was is now the Foreign Secretary and was then, but was a dictionary maker. And I talk about all the words that are going to be gone, all the reference. For some reason, the Marshallese language is full of smell words. Marshallese seem to have an acute sense of smell. There are canoe words. There's nothing. You know, page after page of canoe words. And then fishing terms. Once the computers that were assembling this came to fishing terms, it just went crazy. It started to smoke and spew out page after page of these nuanced fishing terms. Then I have a section on the Caroline Islands where I sail in these traditional Carolinian canoes that where they navigate. There are only two places left in the whole Pacific where traditional celestial navigation, the kind of navigation that colonized the Pacific, still go on. It's a little coral island called Satawal, half a square mile of land, 15 feet above the sea. And there's the Atoll of Puduat, which is a little more land, but it's only 7 feet above the sea. These are the last two places where they have the whole system intact. And I guess I better not go into the system, but it's remarkable. These navigators spend 30 years apprenticeships learning star courses between all the pairs of islands in their system. And they, as the star goes up, they have to switch to another star as a navigation star. And they learn this through mnemonic chants to tell them what star to steer to. They call it the star path. And they have all kinds of target expansion techniques, what the birds are doing, that will tell you where land is. They can read the interference patterns on the surface of the sea that these islands create, that they're going to. They're just remarkable people, and they're at risk now too. So that's really what my book is about, and just trying to evoke these places for people.
So Ken, this is Allison. You mentioned that countries like the Maldives, they're going to, these low-lying islands in the Pacific, that they're actually going to disappear because of sea level rise brought about by climate change. And I'm just wondering, what's the response of these countries? What are they going to be doing? Are they going to be relocating folks, evacuating people to other higher elevation islands? Maybe you could tell us a little bit.
As with us, the planning is rudimentary and is not really happening the way it should be. We, you know, we are not doing much about a real planning for this event. I know that on the Gila River you're thinking about it, but our government is not doing a very good job, and we have things in the offing like the Keystone Pipeline and the tar sands of Alberta that we're still trying to work. We're still trying to drill, baby, drill. So our planning is that it is really at odds with itself. You know, we continue to invest in this expansion of fossil fuels, even as we talk about trying to plan for what those fuels are causing. There's been a lot of pleas before the UN by these small nations. The one I'm most familiar with is the president of the Maldives. Abdul Qayyum, an old dictator, he's been there for 30 years, but he makes a very good speech before the UN, but he repeats it. He reminded me always of Haile Selassie and the very famous old newsreels of the Emperor of Ethiopia before the League of Nations, as Mussolini's tanks rolled over Ethiopia, making a plea to the world to help this small, outmanned African nation against this oppression. And the Qayyum's talks are very much the same. He gets up before the UN and says, we we're poor people in these small islands. Nobody knows about us. We have tiny carbon footprints. We're not causing this, but we're the ones who are suffering from what you and the overdeveloped world have foisted on us. And he goes back again and again, and nothing happens. There have been plans to move, rudimentary beginning plans to move the people from the Maldives and other atoll nations. The successor of Gayoom really got this going a bit. He's been replaced again by the old dictator, but he, a number of Muslim nations have offered to put up the people from the Maldives. But Bangladesh, for example, there was a man who sort of offered the coast of, well, all these ships are broken up. You know, if you've ever seen that where all ships go to die, this greasy sea of oil and broken boats. I mean, it's not what these idyllic islands of the Maldives are like at all. They're absolutely beautiful, pristine places. And it's a different kind of Islam in the Maldives. It's not an Islam of fatwas and jihadists, and there's not a big caste system. And women's rights are much better taken care of. So the prospects aren't great for the move. The other thing that the whole world is doing, and these low islands are doing too, is just denial. Getting on with your life because the prospect is so daunting that there seems to be nothing else to do. The other thing is these people sort of know the whims of the ocean. They've had a number of sort of approximations of what it's going to be like every time a typhoon comes, because these typhoons rip up the land. And in fact, typically the typhoon is what caused people to leave these atolls and these canoe diasporas that colonized the whole Pacific. So they sort of know the routine, and maybe that makes it less, makes them a little slower to do something. But imagine evacuating a whole republic. It's not an easy proposition.
It sounds like a kind of a grim prospect for some of those islands. And right after the break, we'll talk about the similarities between the impacts of the islands and what we can expect right here in the Southwest U.S. So please stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters. Today we have a special guest, Kenneth Brower, joining us from Berkeley. Kenneth Brower is the keynote speaker for this year's Gila River Festival on Thursday, September 19th at 7 p.m. at the Global Resource Center on the Western New Mexico University campus. So, Ken, you talked before the break about the impacts to some island nations, impacts from climate change, and I wonder if you could make a connection between what will happen on some of these island nations and what we can expect to see right here in the Southwest U.S.
Yeah, it's on the face of it, it seems like a hard connection because these places are so different. You know, we're in the Southwest, we're high up in desert mountains in the middle of the continent, and these low island people are in the middle of the ocean on land that just barely peaks above the surface of the ocean. And there's no Gila River. There are no atolls with even a stream or a creek on them because there are these tiny watersheds on sand. So the water, a good deal of water rains on them often, but it all percolates down. But there is a connection, and I think the common denominator or the unifier is water. Underneath every inhabited coral island is something called the Gyben-Hertzberg lens. It's a freshwater lens. You cannot have humans on an atoll without the existence of this lens. People have to have water. So this lens doesn't flow like the Gila or any other river. It just lies under the island, but it's essential. And I've often thought that if people take them for granted, these lenses. But I thought if you could sort of raise it above the island, this beautiful lenticular, it's lens-shaped reservoir, it would make an incredible jewel above this island. And it's a way I like to think about it because it's essential. And what happens on these places, with typhoons or with overuse of water is you get saltwater incursion in the Geibel-Hertzberg lens. You get, if you overuse the well on your island, if you're an island person, if there are too many people on your atoll or your island, you get this downconing around the wells and this incursion of salt water. It takes a long time for it to clear up. And almost all these wells taste a little brackish to begin with. The U.S. government really found out about this in the Navy on Kwajalein Atoll, the biggest atoll in the world, where we still have a base. And because Western civilized man uses inordinate amounts of water, they drew this down too far, and they had lots of salt and incursion. What happens, the main thing that happens with a typhoon is besides ripping up the islands, it tears channels all the way through these long linear islands of the atoll, it pollutes the freshwater lands. And if the typhoon is bad enough, and if the pollution is bad enough, if salt incursion is heavy enough, people have to abandon. And this is how the Pacific Islands were settled. People get driven away in these fleets of canoes from their home atoll, and they have to find another. And it's clear to everyone who's studied this question in the low islands of the world that before the islands sink under, long before, the people will have left for lack of water, because before they sink, they're going to the storms, the typhoons that come through are going to be amplified. Every inch of additional sea level amplifies the effects of these storms. It tears more holes through the reef, tears more holes through the islands, and pollutes these lenses. So lack of water, and this water problem, is going to be what drives the people off before they sink.
So we're going to shift gears here, Ken. This is Allison, and talk a little bit about your recent book, The Wildness Within, which honors your father's memory, the pioneering environmentalist David Brower, honors his memory on the centennial of his birth. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your dad and tell us a bit about some of the folks that you interviewed for your book and some of their stories about your father. And, you know, he also talked a lot about climate change and what he'd be telling us here as we work to protect our rivers, help these island nations in the Pacific deal with climate change.
Well, my dad was the first executive director of the Sierra Club in 1952, and he was only the second full-time employee of the club. You know, it's hard for us to realize or to remember how new this environmental movement is. The Sierra Club is really one of the first, well, was the first big organization. There were 7,000 members when my dad joined. It was mostly a hiking club. By the time he left, it was 70,000. So he was only the second. The first was a Virginia Ferguson, a secretary. The result of my dad's being really one of the first, there were no non-profit like conservationists in the country, one or two, Howard Zonizer, Wilderness Society, one or two others. But as a result of being the first, he really had to do everything. He was the CEO of the outfit. He was a lobbyist in Washington and at the state level. He was a grassroots organizer. He was a publisher. He had to be the photographer. He's sort of like a staff photographer. He had to write the ads. He had to do the videography. He was not the video then, it was filmmaking. And he did all these things well. It was amazing because he had to. At that time in the history of this movement, there was no sort of differentiation of roles. He wound up doing all these things. I just finished this book on Hetch Hetchy a month or two ago, about the possibility of restoring the free flowing Tuolumne River through Hetch Hetchy Valley. No sooner did Yosemite Park get established than San Francisco built a dam inside the park and for power and for water. And my father, in one day, went up to Yosemite and Hetch Hetchy, and with 500 feet of film, spending one day half in Yosemite and half in Hetch Hetchy, he made a pretty good film. He must have used every inch of that 500 feet. That's all he could afford. And it's a film that stands up today about the damage that dam did to the valley, and about sort of the lies that were told by the advocates of the dam about how innocuous it would be and how beautiful it would be. It's when the dam draws down, it's a wasteland. It's all dust storms, and that's not how it was presented to the public. So my dad really started. It's interesting to remember how this movement began. Really, the environmental movement owes a lot to the fight for free-flowing rivers. In 1952, just after he started, my father sort of led the campaign to save Dinosaur National Monument from two dams, the Yump and the Green. And it really was one of the sort of prototypic campaign. It was a book. He commissioned a book. Wally Stegner wrote the book. There was a slideshow. There were trips down the river to sort of build a constituency for the Yump and the Green to let people know about it. If people don't know about these places, the exploiters get them. So you have to have people who care and love a place to know about it. So he did grassroots organizing, and he testified in Washington. And they stopped those dams. And then the next campaign that really brought the Sierra Club to national prominence was just to stop the two dams that were in the Grand Canyon. And my father sort of led that fight, although there were many others involved. And in the late 50s and early 60s, I remember as a kid, he was working a lot on the Wilderness Act. It was further development of this idea that Aldo Leopold began in the Gila wilderness, our first wilderness, and this was an idea of developing a whole wilderness system. So those were things I remember from childhood as totally involving his time.
Yeah, so we wondered about some of the people that you interviewed for The Wildness Within and what they remembered about their encounters with your father.
I could have interviewed a lot more. I really took the first 19 or 20 in through the door, and I wish there's many I missed. But what they tended to remember collectively, it seems to me, was his boldness. He really believed in boldness. He had this quote from Goethe that he use all the time. If there is something you can do or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. Boy, that's a good quote, and it was certainly true of him. I think his genius was in his boldness. If you see what you have to do, you just have to begin it, because all things, fate starts to move with you as with that commitment. And I think all the people I interviewed remembered the energy that was released in him by that kind of commitment. He had more physical energy than anybody I've ever met. I think part of it, sometimes I ask, was it just there? Did the physical energy come first, or was it just the commitment to the cause? And I think it was both. I think he was a super multi-peak day climber. He had a lot of physical energy. But I think when you commit to an idea like as he did, it really releases power. He believed in commitment to action, and the people I interviewed all remembered that. It wasn't just talk. It wasn't just making the right noises. You had to get results, and